The All University Congress this evening welcomes all of you who are here to the Thy McCarthy debate. I think the Sputnik in the sky, the discussions at Warsaw, and the squabble over Quimoy are symbolic of an age in which foreign affairs is of particular importance. Thus, I think it quite apropos this evening that we have before you this evening a discussion of American foreign policy. And I think it of even greater significance that this discussion, this debate, shall take part between Senator Edward Thigh and Representative Eugene McCarthy, candidates for the United States Senate. At the outset, I would like to indicate to you, first in form of acknowledgement, those who have made this debate possible. The debate, as I mentioned before, is sponsored by the All University Congress, the assistance of the Department of Concerts and Lectures. I would like to acknowledge those on the planning committee for this debate, Dr. Robert Scott from the Speech Department of the University of Minnesota, Mr. James Lombard, Director of Department of Concerts and Lectures, Mr. James Reeves of the Student Activities Bureau, and Andy Johnson, the Vice President of the All University Congress. I would also like to acknowledge the assistance from the YMCA, from the Students for McCarthy, the YDFL, and the Young Republicans, who helped a great deal in the publicity and assisting with the procedures for this debate. Let me indicate to you generally the procedure which will be followed this evening. First, there will be a 20-minute constructive speech by each of the speakers, Representative McCarthy being first, followed by Senator Thigh. Then, following will be an 8-minute rebuttal in the same order, followed then by 2 minutes in rejoinder form for each of the two candidates. At the end of the formal discussion, the formal presentation of the debate, will follow a 30-minute question period. And let me outline to you the procedure for questions. We have ushers in the back of the room who are equipped with little 3x5 cards, who when a person raises his hand at the end of this, will give to you a little card. And on the card, would you please indicate your question and the person to whom you would address it. And the usher will then relay this to the stage, and then I will present the questions to the respective candidates. The discussion, as I mentioned, will be limited to approximately 30 minutes immediately following the debate. And let me mention, too, a reception which will be held immediately succeeding the question period will be held at the YMCA. Now, to get to the YMCA, and I'll remind you at the end of the debate, too, I hope, you just go on the main drive to my immediate right here, about a block and a half north through University Avenue, and on the northwest corner is the YMCA. And at the northwest corner, the YMCA, in the great hall of the YMCA, the reception will take place. At the reception, I might mention you can ask any further questions on your mind and also have some coffee and donuts. Well, at this time, without further ado, I would like to introduce the candidate who will first speak, Representative Eugene McCarthy. Representative McCarthy was born in Watkins, Minnesota in 1914. After graduating from St. John's College and receiving a degree from the University of Minnesota, he taught in public schools in Minnesota and two private colleges. He was elected to the House of Representatives from the 4th Congressional District in 1948 and has been reelected 4 successive times. He has represented the United States at a number of international conferences. He was a delegate to the London Interparliamentary Conference in 1956. In 1957, he was appointed to act as a Ways and Means Committee observer at the Geneva meeting of the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, the body which is concerned with reductions of trade barriers. Without further ado, at this time, I would like to bring to you the first constructive speaker, Representative Eugene McCarthy. McCarthy.
Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Anderson, Senator Thigh, and ladies and gentlemen, I was pleased that the chairman spoke of two constructive speeches. I was afraid I would have to explain why, as a Democrat, I was giving the affirmative speech in this debate, since it would be somewhat difficult to affirm a negative foreign policy. Well, in any case, as the chairman here tonight said, this is an important year in foreign policy. It's an important year for decision, and therefore a most important year and season in which we ought to discuss foreign policy. I've given through my years in Congress, at least since we've had a Republican president, and the Republicans have had responsibility for foreign policy, some thought to the question of the responsibility of the minority party, or in those sessions of Congress when the Democrats had a majority, of the party of opposition, or the party which did not control the White House, and particularly in relation to foreign policy. I have concluded and acted on the general rule that it is better to have a foreign policy which is somewhat inadequate, but to have that policy at least generally supported insofar as legislative action is concerned. And so it has been my rule to support the requests of the administration with regard to authority when I thought they needed authority, and with regard to appropriations, since I assumed that their requests for appropriations, insofar as I was able to honor them, were within reason and in order. I did object to one request for authority, namely their Middle East resolution, but on the grounds that this was a request for authority which the President already had. And it seemed to me that after the 1956 election, in which the President had just been approved for another four-year term, that it was really quite unnecessary for him to come to the Congress and ask us to pass a resolution which in effect said he could do what the Constitution and the traditions of this country permitted him to do. And I thought there was a further danger in that resolution in that it established certain conditions, at least in the resolution, conditions for action in the Middle East, conditions which I was quite sure, once they were laid down in paper, at least the communists would never permit these particular conditions to arise. And so it set a kind of artificial limitation upon our freedom of action and the President's freedom of action in that area which we then knew to be critical. And of course, the action in Lebanon, most recently taken, was taken outside the terms and the authority of the Middle East resolution. Now to discuss foreign policy and to get on to at least some points of difference, I move ahead somewhat hesitantly since, as you know, the Vice President has said that just recently that the people cannot be relied upon with regard to foreign policy because they're not adequately informed. And the President, even more recently, has said that it's not quite proper to discuss foreign policy if you're going to be critical. Well, it seems to me this establishes a rather difficult situation. Since if you discuss it critically, as I feel it must be discussed, you then inform the people. And if you do not discuss it critically, then the people are not informed. So you can never move ahead in what is considered to be the normal progress or procedure of democracy of educating at base the citizens, of giving them the information which is fundamental to the proper working of democratic government. Because without that basis in fact and in knowledge, no matter how much goodwill you may have, no matter how much resolution you may have among the people, they cannot make wise and proper decisions. And I think this is a point we must keep in mind continuously, that in a democracy, every citizen possesses political power. And that power is exercised not only on domestic issues, but it is exercised on international issues and international policy. And so only in the measure that the people are wise, that they are informed and possess a measure of goodwill, can we expect in the long run that our foreign policy will have direction and that it will be constructive. Now, in passing judgment upon the foreign policy record of this administration, I do want to establish this one point, that no one of us, of course, expects that all of the problems of the world should have been solved between 1952 and 1958. The standard for judging any political regime is not that of whether it's established a perfect order in a perfect society or not, because we look too long to find that kind of progress, but rather to pass fair judgment within the context of history, to pass judgment as to whether or not under this particular administration We have made as much progress as we could have expected to have been made in the way of advancing the cause of justice and peace, or whether even if the forces which were working against peace and against justice were extremely strong, if there was regression, whether the regression was slowed and the direction of it channeled into the proper directions. So we pass this judgment against a background of history which makes for a kind of relative judgment, but a fair judgment nonetheless. And I think we can best start by going back to the state of the world as it existed in 1952. The immediate issue, of course, of great interest then was the Korean War. But at the time of the election in 1952, and certainly at the time that this administration took office, the basic military phase of the Korean War was over. And the question which faced the country was that of working out some kind of terms for continuous existence. The condition in Western Europe, World War II was over, not all was well, but the Marshall Plan had been put into effect, and there was a measure of stability in all of the countries of Western Europe. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was a living and a growing thing, and Greece and Turkey had been stabilized, and there was no question about how this nation stood in support of the State of Israel in the Middle East. In North Africa, at least, there was no trouble. And the indications were that we had some friends in that country. And we were going ahead with plans and with the actual construction of military bases for United States forces in that part of the world. The Japanese treaty was almost ready to be signed. And it was accepted that the good neighbor policy with regard to South America and Canada was still in effect. Well, under these circumstances, you may recall the campaign of 1952. The Korean War was labeled Truman's War and Truman's Folly. And the man who wrote the first and most bitter denunciation of it in the Republican Policy Committee, or platform, for the campaign of 1952 was Mr. John Foster Dulles, who had been in the State Department under Harry Truman and had recommended the Korean action. And when he was called to explain this seeming contradiction, he said to the Secretary of State, essentially, he had to be responsible. But once the campaign started, he said, you became an advocate and attempted to have your side win. Well, now, this revelation in itself, I think, should create some doubts in our minds as to the general reliability of the Secretary of State. But this was the campaign of 1952 with regard to the Korean War. The second great cry was liberation. They denounced the program which the Democrats had been following as a policy and program of what they called immoral containment. And this was characteristic of the campaign of 1952, to make distinctions, or at least to attempt to make them, in terms of what was moral and what was immoral. This was the tone of the whole crusade of 1952. As a matter of fact, it was a tone which was established even before they began the contest with the Democrats. This was the tone of the Eisenhower movement in the Republican Convention, in which they distinguished between the good Republicans who were for Eisenhower and the bad ones who were for Taft. And they even talked about stealing votes, Republican votes in Georgia. Well, that takes some stealing. They talked about the sellout of China. And this, of course, is a long story. We need not go into it. They talked about unleashing Chiang Kai-shek and said quite openly that the Seventh Fleet, if the Republicans were elected, would no longer be used to protect the Chinese communists from the national Chinese on Formosa. This was said at the campaign of 1952. The presidential candidate said he was going to repudiate all secret agreements because these were the things which evidently had gotten us into trouble. And they said they were going to shake the foreign policy of this nation out of what they called its posture of paralyzed tension. Instead of that, we were to have a bold, dynamic foreign policy. Instead of patience and forbearance, which Adlai Stevenson called for in that campaign, in talking about the difficulty of the problems, the Republican candidate speaking in Montana said that we'd had too much of patience. And he said to the people there, and in effect to the people of this nation, remember your own power and know that you can accomplish anything. Well, now it seems to me that this was a great call to irresponsibility. Considering the circumstances, considering the conditions of the world, to make a statement of that kind and to go on to oversimplify and say, as the president or the candidate then said, if men of goodwill sit down together, he said, they come up with the right answers. Well, of course, the clear implication was that there must have been men who were not of goodwill in the Democratic administration. And it was clearly stated, of course, that they were not going to have anyone in this next administration unless he was a man of goodwill. And so once they were established in power, you had this problem. They sat down together, and they weren't sure as to what should be done. Well, now, under these circumstances, having established this as the principle upon which you're going to operate and the principle upon which foreign policy is to be conducted, you're in some difficulty. Because if you make a decision and it turns out to be wrong, then, in effect, you have to admit that there must be someone in your administration who is not a man of goodwill. And this was the procedure. For a while, they hesitated. And then when they made a few mistakes, they said the reason was that there were some old Atchison people left in the State Department. The explanations were that simple. And you may have remembered the remarks of one congressman from this state who said that the reason John Foster Dulles was kept flying around so much was that these holdover Democrats and Atchison people wanted to keep him out of the State Department so they could make the decisions. Well, now, this was a seriously made statement. And about the same time, an administration spokesman said that John Foster Dulles liked to fly, that he thought better at high altitudes. Well, what is the record? In 1958, Chiang Kai-shek has been unleashed. And the Seventh Fleet is no longer protecting the Chinese communists. We know what the situation is in the Far East. If it were not for the kind of statements they made, I would not treat it in this somewhat light fashion. But this is what they said in 1952. And we know what the serious facts are today. What about liberation? There's no talk of liberation. Liberation died with the Hungarian Revolt. When we stood idly by, it wouldn't have been so bad, really, if we'd stood idly by, but we were off chastising our allies, the French and the British, in Egypt. What about North Africa? You've seen the papers within the last week or two in which the people of Morocco are saying, we want you out of here within 3 years. And we say, well, let us stay for 5. Now, it may be that these bases have served their purpose, but in any case, we still seem to think that we ought to be there for 5 years, and they are saying we want you out within 3 years. We've talked a great deal about colonialism. We've talked about the immorality of neutralism, but we've not come up with any kind of consistent or any kind of far-sighted program, or any genuine offer which would help the people who do have colonial problems, or which would help the people who are by necessity, in many cases, forced to be neutral as they are. But what about the secret agreements which were going to be repudiated? Well, after that statement was issued, the president was going to send up to us in Congress a resolution to take care of this. And when he was asked which secret agreements he wished to repudiate, he said he didn't know of any. And he never sent a resolution to us. Well, what about the good neighbor policy? Under the Democrats, the vice president could go to South America and come home without alerting the Marines. Now, this is just a superficial indication of what's wrong In South America and Canada, you've had a development within recent years. They've begun to feel their economic strength. They've begun to, at least there are indications that they can become responsible nations and make a genuine contribution to the civilization of the Western world. But they need to have some economic advantages. They need to have some economic opportunities. And so here are we, the great and powerful nation, the great economic strength of the Western world, hamstringing and setting obstacles in the way of their progress. And so it's quite understandable that they should protest and be distressed with it. And in the Far East, we have the Formosan crisis in 54 and 55. We have a Formosa crisis again in 1958. And we had, of course, the crisis in Indochina, in which, after our administration, at least if the Vice President was speaking for it, we took three positions, one that we should go in, one that we would go in, and the third that we would not go in. And most of us did not know what was going on, you know, because that was in the time when the line was that we were making progress because the President, it was accepted that the President was a man seeking peace by peaceful means. And this we lived under, and this we accepted. Until in early 1956, there appeared a white paper in Life magazine by John Foster Dulles in private interview, in which he told us that we'd been to the brink three times. And he said that it was going to the brink of war that was responsible for the progress which we had made. Now, which was it? Was it the acceptance that the President was seeking by peaceful means to advance the cause of peace? Or was it that John Foster Dulles was going to the brink of war at every critical point in history up to that time? Well, say, these are things in the record of this administration. And I would like to make just one final point, and I hope this meets the standard of being constructive. But I think the failure of this administration really is manifest in three general areas. One, a misunderstanding of the nature of defense in this critical time. We have talked of massive retaliation and always retreated to the point of saying we have the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb, a more efficient one, a more effective one, and in greater supply. We have the ultimate weapon. We had it during Korea. We had it during Indochina. We have it today, but it's no help to us. As one man described this nation, in a figurative sense, he said, we're on the verge of becoming like the last of the now extinct prehistoric birds, the roc, standing guard over an unfertilized egg. Well, I don't think it's quite that bad, but this great emphasis on massive retaliation and the H-bomb is no answer to the military problems of the day. And secondly, they fail to understand the importance and the function of what we call Western civilization, that which is in the Judaic Christian Renaissance tradition. Fail to understand that what is involved in this contest with the communists today is a kind of total challenge of history in which our whole way of life, our political philosophy, our spiritual beliefs, our moral practices, our economic system, our social institutions, that all of these are on trial. And this is what Khrushchev said about a year and a half ago. He said, we're putting you to the total test. He said, you stand the test of peace and prosperity, but anyone can stand that. And he said, you've stood the test of total war, but when you stand that test, you stand it not as free democracies, but you stand it under a totalitarian regime. And he said, now we're trying you. Not necessarily militarily, but there if we need to. But in the field of economic competition, in the field of science, in all phases and aspects of culture. And this, it seems to me, is the fundamental and perhaps the most serious failure in the understanding of this administration. And the third failure is with regard to the neutral and the uncommitted nations, the backward nations. When we should have moved forward with the Point 4 program, and we should have continued to accept responsibility, as we did in the Korean War, for people with whom we had little in common, people for whom we had no primary and immediate responsibility, people from whom we could get no direct and immediate help. We accepted responsibility. And I suppose that that war is, in the history of mankind, the most idealistic war ever fought from the point of view of the United States. But all of this, it seems, has not quite been lost, but it's been permitted to drift and to fade and to shadow out. And so I say this is the issue, I think, in this campaign. If we had a cabinet system of government, we could draw the issue at any critical time. The Congress could stand against the party in power. And if we could vote them down, then we could go to the people. But in this democracy, that is not the procedure. The Founding Fathers provided for periodic elections, 2, 4, and 6 years. The most important time to discuss foreign policy, of course, is in a presidential election, because the president is most responsible for foreign policy. But second in responsibility is the United States Senate. And so, despite what the president may have said, and accepting that the vice president may in part be right, but accepting also that a candidate for the United States Senate, or candidates for the United States Senate, since they have this very fundamental responsibility under the Constitution and in the traditions of this country, that we have a great obligation to talk about the issues, the foreign policy issues in this campaign, and to come to you, the voters, and particularly those of you who have responsibility here for forming the mind and will of the people of this state, to ask you to consider with us the record of this administration, the program of this administration, and to pass judgment upon this against the background of what our great responsibilities are and of what the demands of this particular period in history actually are.
I introduce to you our other speaker for this evening, speaking secondly, present senator from the state of Minnesota, Senator Edward Thigh. One of a family of 11, his parents moved from Minnesota, from South Dakota. In 1942, he ran and was elected lieutenant governor. 1943, assumed the position of governor of the state of Minnesota. He was reelected to the position in 1944, by the then largest majority ever received by a candidate for office in the state of Minnesota. Through his senior position in the Senate, Thigh is ranking minority member of the Small Business Committee, third ranking minority member of the Agricultural Committee, and fifth ranking minority member of the Appropriations Committee. At this time, I would like to introduce to you Senator Edward Thigh.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, Congressman McCarthy. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a distinct pleasure to be privileged to stand in this auditorium and face you on this evening. The last time that I was privileged to stand in this auditorium was the then inauguration of President Morrill of this great university. I was then governor of this state. And as we discussed the international and the world situation this evening, you and I, as a citizen of the greatest nation on earth, must realize that the responsibility of world leadership rests upon your shoulders and mine, the shoulders of the citizens of this nation. If you and I fail in that international, that world leadership, you can be certain that the Soviet will take it. This I have been mindful of in all of the years that I've been privileged to serve you in the Senate since the conclusion of World War II. I was in the Air Force in 1917 and 18. I saw the horrors of war. And I pledged myself as I returned to this land that I should do my little bit in trying to preserve this great nation, because I had witnessed the areas of the world where our people came from to a great extent that populated the wilderness of this North America to build a nation. And I marveled at the achievement of our parents in what they'd accomplished in such a relatively short time, as I had been privileged to see the foreign country. and that they had not kept pace with their children that left them and came into the wilderness of North America. So you and I here tonight, in the last month of the campaign, are reviewing the past in order that we look forward with a degree of intelligence into the future, insofar as our nation and our foreign policy is concerned. When I went to the United States Senate, I sought the Appropriations Committee for reasons that I felt that I could in that manner not only serve the state, but I could directly serve in a military way when it was a question of appropriations. Or I could serve in the international field if it was a question of international relief that would alleviate some of the hardships and hunger that I knew existed in some of the areas of the world because of the displacement that wars had wrought and brought upon a people. And when I entered in upon the duties as a senator, I commenced to see the results of some of the mistakes that had been committed during the prosecution of World War II. What were they? I think that the leaders, both of this nation and those allied with us, were not wise international strategists or diplomats when they first permitted the Russian military to enter Berlin, thereby taken thereby taken possession of those research laboratories, not only the notes of the scientist, but yes, the individual himself. They denied the Western world the right to liberate those scientists that had been shackled to the regime of the Hitlerism. Had we have succeeded of taking some of those scientists out of that area, we might have progressed faster with the missiles than we did. I came into the city of Berlin by air in 49. We left by train. And when we boarded the train that evening, we, of course, were in the United States sector, in the British sector of Berlin. As our train departed, it was but a few minutes that the military guards of the Russian army proceeded to draw the curtains right in the presence of us and station their guards in either end of the coach. We were then on Russian territory. The Russians had outsmarted the leaders of this nation and the others by having a quarter about the city of Berlin that involved this nation in an airlift that endangered every young man of our land that flew that airlift in order that we might supply our sector under that blockade. That was not good diplomacy or diplomatic dealings on the, nor was it good military understanding when that was done. The same thing was true in Vienna. You had to travel over 20 miles of Russian territory to get into your sector of the city of Vienna. Let's now go one step further in what we had committed as blunders that led to the Korean conflict, and that was when the division of Korea at the 38th parallel. There, of course, was a mistake made that brought about the North Korean endeavoring to invade the Southern Korea. The war was not at an end when President Eisenhower took office. Indeed, it was not. The blood of youth of America was being spilled upon those rocky, mountainous terrain. The president went there himself, and as a military general, reviewed the situation and tried to plan for an ending of that conflict, and he did. the war came to an end. As a member of the Appropriations Committee, I then studied how could we best assist that little country of South Korea to reestablish a production, an agricultural production that would feed its people, to say nothing about clothing. And I went to Korea as a member of the Appropriations Committee. I studied the situation there. We aided in a rebuilding of the South Korean, its farming operations. We have a splendid army of Korean young men that is not costing us anywhere near the cost that it would to maintain American troops in armed forces. They stand there as a military might in South Korea guarding the Pacific. I came across Vietnam on the return. I knew that North Vietnam was lost. There was nothing there for either the native to fight for, and it was nothing there as a people that wanted to support the French. I so reported to President Eisenhower. Notwithstanding what had been said one way or another by anyone, I informed the President on that return trip from Vietnam that I said the French cannot and will not hold that northern Vietnam area for more than 120 days, and I question if it'll be that long. And I gave my specific reasons. I will not comment on the President's remarks because those are never referred to. France did not hold North Vietnam. Why? Because there was nothing there for a people to fight for. That's one reason why, my good friends, that I have supported mutual security appropriations even when the House had failed by many hundreds of millions of dollars. And I want to report to you that I was on the conference committee of the last appropriation session of this 85th Congress. I was there in the late hours of that night, last night. And the last discussion I had with the House conferees was on the basis that if you do not yield, if you do not come somewhere near what the President has asked in mutual security, if you do not come somewhere near what the Joint Chiefs of Staff of our defense says is a necessity, I shall not sign the report. And I did not sign the report. I would not surrender to the House that night because I said that they had failed their president. They had failed the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They'd failed you because we were then confronted with the Middle East problems. We were then confronted with a threatened reshelling of the Formosa Strait Islands. Now, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, I'm a member of the Military Appropriations Subcommittee. I've sat through the months and months of hearings when oftentimes there'd be as many as 15 or more generals from a one star to a four, and if I saw a colonel in World War I, even though I had bars on my own shoulder, I stood in awe of him. And when I looked out in front of me in that Appropriations Committee and I saw as many as 10 to more generals and possibly 8 or 9 admirals, and they given us a report of what our defense needs were and what we were doing in the missile field, I fully realized what a responsibility rested upon the shoulders of those of us that had to make the recommendations, not only about military appropriations, but also mutual security. And I want to review a little of what President Eisenhower has done for you as the leader of this great nation since he took office, but these few years ago. He brought the Korean conflict to an end. Remember that. Secondly, he strengthened the NATO alliance. I attended the NATO Parliamentary Conference, of which my friend, and I say my friend, because Congressman McCarthy and I had been friends up in, and we're still friends. But they've declared an open season on Senator Thigh, and some of them started shooting out of season. But I say to my friend, we are politically opponents, I'll assure you of that. And I haven't covered this state from end to end as I have in these weeks. And just letting you in on a little secret, Mrs. Thigh has never, ever passed out a folder until I caught her doing it the other night. I was speaking in Wilmer, and they'd backed a truck out in front of a building for the purpose of a platform. And a high school band was playing on the steps of the building and attracted a great audience. And when I was being introduced, I looked across the street, and behold, my wife was standing there with an arm full of pamphlets and was passing them out to the folks. So I tell you, we're in this campaign. Don't ever think we aren't. Now let's review some of the achievements under President Eisenhower. Strengthening of the NATO alliance, and I said that I was on the verge of telling you that I had been at the NATO Parliamentary Conference with my friend, the congressman, in 1956. I tried my best to bring about an understanding and good relations between us and the delegates from the other parliaments or the other legislative bodies of the affiliated nation. I met with the Scandinavian delegations in private and personal conferences, and I met with the Icelanders, and so forth. I was asked to go back the next year. But then I had served on that special investigating committee that had gone into in detail the oil lobby activities that involved first the senator from South Dakota, Senator Case, and the entire honor of the Congress. Because if they were endeavoring to buy votes, that did involve you and your Congress. And I was on a four-man special committee by resolution, serving with the late Senator George and Senator Carl Hayden of Arizona, now President Pro Tem of the Senate, and our Republican President Pro Tem of the Senate, Stiles Bridges, and the Senate named me as the fourth man on that committee. We went through a lengthy hearing. We went through another lengthy hearing when another resolution passed and created an eight-man committee. And our report as an eight-man committee created the McClellan Committee. And therefore, having served on all of these special committees, I could not take another assignment that took me away from the United States, and therefore I rejected, both last year and again this year, the honor of being a delegate from the United States Senate to the NATO Parliamentary Conferences. Now I'll go to the other. The establishment of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, the passage and the establishment of the Eisenhower Doctrine for the Middle East, the admission of West Germany to the NATO forces, the wisdom of President Eisenhower working with the West German government, aiding them to reestablish themselves as a strong, sovereign nation, has given us strength in the NATO forces. The settlement of the Trieste dispute the Austrian peace treaty. Say nothing about the defense aviation bases in Spain, the Navy base there. I went to Spain twice on that assignment as a member of the Military Appropriations Committee. Was there, made arrangements to pay for much of that construction cost with surpluses from our bountiful harvests of our agricultural areas. Yes, we had paid last summer more than $183 million worth of those base costs with your agricultural surpluses. The International Atomic Energy Agency, a part of the Eisenhower Autumns for Peace proposal, which is now working with 67 nations as participants. These are the accomplishments of the President Eisenhower administration in the foreign field that is giving to you strength to resist communism. Strength to resist communism. The president acted decisively in the Middle East. And he sent his troops into Lebanon, your troops, the troops of this nation. The uprising came to an end. We're over in the Formosa Straits now, yes. But I ask you, if we were not decisive, did not we show courage? Would it not be that if we stepped back from those islands, would we then be safe on Formosa? Would we not be confronted with the question of do we fight over Formosa? And certainly we could not give up Formosa. If we gave up Formosa, then you would be faced with Okinawa, and you've got great military bases in Okinawa. It's a part of your Pacific defense. If Okinawa fell, you have the Philippines, you have all those lesser nations over there, to say nothing about the blood that was spilled, not only on Pacific, but on air and everywhere, to try to attain peace over in the Pacific as well as bringing that conflict to an end in Japan. And if Japan was again sitting there, threatened by communistic invasion, what would you be faced in the Pacific with? And so the question is simply this, that even though there were those that clamored for a special session after they had voted for given the president the authority to act over there as he's acted, weakening the hand of the president, encouraging the communists to press a little harder, because sooner or later they'll get a special session and then we'll have a free-for-all on the Senate floor and in Congress. Oh, I tell you, the president has been courageous, and we're coming a step closer to a peace situation year by year. And that we cannot have an atomic war. I know what is in the making in the bombs, both hydrogen and atomic, and the missiles are becoming too accurate in their designs and perfection, and they're only about 30 minutes away from you, anywhere else in the world. And if they rain bombs upon you, even though your interceptors were to explode them in the air, they would rain a deadly fallout that would poison all living things. If they exploded on the earth, they would spew off a deadly fallout in a like manner. Therefore, war cannot come. I could go on and talk to you further, but the time has been signaled me. But remember this. Don't forget that you have a UN, and build on it, because through it, you can build an international organization for the governing of conduct of men, such as the action of Nasser, when he blocked the Suez Canal. Been nice to have been privileged to make this talk. Thank you.
We will now proceed to rebuttal, and the first speaker is Representative McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thigh, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I find some difficulty in noting just where to join the issue. I suppose I could make the point that the two decisions regarding the one regarding Berlin and the other with regarding the 38th parallel, so far as we can discover, that each of these were military decisions made primarily in the field, one by a great general who turned out to be a Republican, General Eisenhower, and the other by another general who, I think he was a Republican all the time, General MacArthur. And I will not argue about the wisdom or the measure of responsibility for those decisions, since I think whether we were responsible or not, the Democrats were held accountable for that in the election of 1952. And so what we're now concerned about is what has happened between 52 and 58, what trends we're able to determine, what drift, if there is drift, is taking place. To say that we have peace is really not much of an argument. If this were the standard, then we should have claimed today Neville Chamberlain instead of Winston Churchill. Now, I do not say that we should have gone to war, or even to the brink of war, as we're reported to have done. But I do say the simple proposition that there is no shooting, that this is not the answer to the question which this nation faces today. The question is one of whether or not we have things under reasonable control. And this is the question, really. And I think that I covered it at least as well as I can, or as well as I should in this debate, in my preliminary statement. I would like to talk to you just a little bit about some of the experiences that I had at NATO parliamentary conferences and in other international conferences, particularly at the time of the Suez crisis. I talked to members of the French government, and they said, we were distressed at having to take this action. But we went to your government and said, what do you want us to do? And they said, we won't tell you. And we said, will you support us if we take action? And they said, we won't say. Now, this is what they said happened in Suez. And so they said, we took action. And the Frenchman said, of course, we didn't think the British would fold up under pressure from Washington. And the British had something to say about the French. But in any case, both were agreed that there was no leadership and no positive program and no direction and no assurance from John Foster Dulles. And the British said, he may have a plan. We hope he has. But we've been looking at international affairs for a long time, and if he has one, we can't discover it. Well, I think that's essentially the situation. I think everyone is in grave doubt as to whether or not there is a plan. When, as I said earlier, we are told that the president is advancing things because everyone knows he's seeking to do it by peaceful means, and the Secretary of State says we've been to the brink of war three times. You must have some doubts as to whether there is a policy, or at least whether there is a common policy in the administration. We sent troops to Lebanon. We're taking them out. The rebels are now in power, and those who were in power are the rebels. This is not stability. This does not indicate real progress, and I think that we have a right to expect and to be able to discern some genuine evidence that we are moving along, that there is stability, which at least we can't have it permanently, at least we can say this should last for a short time. To see how we switched with regard to Nasser, we were for him. And then we changed on the Aswan Dam. And what was the justification? Well, they said it's not economically feasible. Well, that may be true, but it was politically feasible. And I might observe that insofar as Egypt is concerned, that the pyramids didn't generate any hydroelectric power. But they stabilized the situation, evidently, some 3,000 years ago. And the United States, in its State Department, could have been expected, it seems to me, since the British and the French and almost anyone else who had an interest in the knowledge of the Middle East was telling them about Nasser, that we shouldn't have taken action which gave a kind of justification, not in law but in politics, for Nasser to take the action he did against the Suez Canal. Well, now to get on to one or two other issues, I would say that I do not hold the senator wholly responsible for this administration's foreign policy. That would be unfair. I mean, because the senator doesn't have it, no senator has that kind of control over it. The primary responsibility is with the administration. But a candidate for the Senate and a man who holds that office must share some responsibility, and I don't want to be unfair. But I do want to talk. I do hope the senator and I don't reach the state that Tommy Gibbons described, the one in which he said he never got so tired of looking at anybody in his life as he did the night he fought Dempsey 15 rounds. We've been on the trail together for some time. But I do want to talk about some votes, differences between his record and mine. These may be peripheral, but in any case, they do relate to the basic question. I pointed out in my opening statement that I voted against the Middle East resolution and gave my reasons for it. I like to think that what's happened recently in the Middle East tends to sustain the position I took. There are three or four other areas. The senator has made the point that the House of Representatives did not approve the full appropriation requested for mutual security, and that is correct. I joined with Congressman Judd and Republicans in trying to get a restoration. So my own record is clear. But I do want to talk about a few votes that the senator has cast in the past. Now, these may not be significant. He may have a good explanation. These were cast when we had a Democratic president, and understandably, he had less confidence in the administration then than he has in a Republican administration. And I suppose I could say I have less confidence in this administration than I had in the Democrats. But nonetheless, I've been voting and trying to get them their full request of foreign aid funds. In the Mutual Security Act of 1951, there was a vote to cut it by $249 million, which the senator approved. There was a vote in 1950 on the extension of the Marshall Plan to cut out aid to all countries. This was the Battle Act, which were trading with the Soviet orbit. This, it seems to me, was short-sighted action. There was a vote in 1950 to delay the enactment of the Point 4 program by creating a commission to study it in 1950. And a vote against establishing the Point 4 program as a part of the Marshall Plan. These votes the senator supported. He voted for the McCarran-Walter Immigration Act, which I think has serious international implications, and on two or three other votes regarding reciprocal trade with which I disagree. So this is a limited kind of area for disagreement, but I think it's significant, particularly with regard to point four. At a time when this seemed a very necessary program, and also, if the general record seems to indicate an inclination to vote to cut and reduce these funds when there's a Democratic president and to support them when there's a Republican president, a change in approach which is not manifest in my voting record. And if I might suggest that in 1960 we're likely to have a Democratic president. But I would like to see a senator there who would certainly support the request of that president.
Second rebuttal speaker for 8 minutes, Senator Thigh.
Thank you. Speaking about reciprocal trade, looking over the record, I couldn't find the congressman voting on reciprocal trade when it was passed in the House on June the 11th of 1958. Now, I do not charge that it's not possible to be absent from the House or the Senate. That does happen. But he had been on record on a roll call earlier in the day. And therefore, it was a sort of a question in my mind because I had been a strong supporter of reciprocal trade. I had to take the floor in the last extension of reciprocal trade and try to defeat a very crippling amendment that was being offered and endeavored to have enacted on the floor of the Senate. Now, one reason why I wanted to study a point four, I'll explain it to you. We had appropriated in the fiscal 1950 $5,173,000,000 for the mutual security or the foreign aid program. We had found that in 1951 we were asked and we did appropriate $7,359,000,000 and we were in the red as a nation. And because of that, I myself, when Milliken, the late Senator Milliken, chairman of the Finance Committee, and some of these men said, we don't know what's in that proposal, and can we not have a study made of it that we might more intelligently proceed with these commitments when we are now confronted with already appropriating $7 billion plus and carrying it over into the 52 year, we found ourselves again appropriating $7,282,000,000 in that appropriation to carry through commitments. That was why I voted for that study committee. Otherwise, I've never been opposed to the foreign program because I recognize that you're not going to have the opportunity of peace if a mother does not know how and in which manner she's going to feed, clothe her children, or to give it modern medicine. When I was in North Vietnam, and when I was taken up near the front sector, as close as they'd let a civilian go, and when I saw not only the civilians coming back crippled and maimed as they were, but the one thing that I shall never forget was this mother standing in this little village of thatched roofs and adobe clay walls in the structure of their homes, standing there turning an old sandstone type of a rice huller, her little body swinging with the movement of that stick that was propelling this sandstone against another one and a hulling the rice. At each side of her were three or four small children hanging on to her limbs or to the rags of her dress, and her son just a short distance away poking away at a water buffalo hooked to a most antiquated piece of implement that you could imagine. She could see her children in need of food and clothing. She could see what we were from the Western world. She could see the modern automobile on the highway, or she could see the plane droning overhead, oftentimes, of course, the military. She knew something else existed beyond her. She, in her care and her love for her children, would be a receptive mind to the communist agent that would come down and say, look at the misery, look at your child with the ulcerated eye for lack of medicine. It'll go blind if it doesn't get a few drops of modern medicine in the next few weeks. Wouldn't she be most receptive to the communist agent that pointed to some wealthy estate over in Hanoi and said, if this was the communistic type of government, you'd have a part of that and you would not have the misery you here see. after that vision or that sight of which has been a mental vision since practically, or a mental picture if not a vision. I have endeavored with point four, I have endeavored in every conceivable manner to bring about an economic uplift in those countries in order that we could make certain that those people would stand with us in respect for our benevolence rather than to stand with us because we might offer them some military strength. And I want to say to you that we've gone forward intelligently with student exchange, professor exchange, and with an understanding type of a program. And we have not spent no $7 billion of dollars doing it. In the 1959 fiscal year's appropriation, we expended $3,298,000,000. It wasn't as much as the president asked for. The House had cut it. We endeavored to have it reinstated in conference. I've reported that to you. But over the years, 1958, we appropriated $2,766,000,000. 57, we appropriated $3,771,000,000. You see the drop? And yet we're going forward with that technical assistance and the student exchange. I just want to relate to you this. I just asked for the time. I've got 2 minutes. Last summer, two Indian students that had been here as a student exchange came to my office on their return. And incidentally, Minnesota had the best record per capita of taking care of student exchange of any state in the Union. And I'm proud of you. I asked these two young students, I said, what were you thinking on your way over here to the United States? They just shrugged their shoulders and had no specific comment. I said, now what do you think after you have lived in our normal home in this land? They said, we didn't believe anything like that existed. We had no knowledge that one family in any place in the world could have such a kitchen as is found in the average home. We had no knowledge that a person could have all that personal property, machinery, livestock, and all that fertile land to till. But the most surprising thing they related was, even though you have all this property equal to that of kings, you work like a peon with your hands. That was the impression. I said, what are you going to say to your people when you return to your country? They said, we're anxious to go back and tell them about you here in America. We're anxious to go back and put into application over there some of the knowledge we've gained amongst you. That's how you will build for friendship that will stand with you against all odds. They'll not stand with you just because you might say, I've got a great military strength. And I think it's more, it's cheaper security than any military operations that you might be engaged in. Military costs are tremendous. The big plane that comes off the assembly line can be obsolete almost as fast as they're rolled out because the engineers have found new methods and designs for it. It costs a tremendous amount to housekeep that defense inventory. We must find a way to bring about an understanding amongst men of this earth if you're going to find a way to a permanent and lasting peace in this terrifying age that we live in with the atomic bomb and the guided missile. And believe me, when the Russians have achieved a missile that which has penetrated the outer space with more than 1,000 pounds of weight, you can be certain that they can penetrate you and that we can penetrate their areas with an equal destructive weight in bombs as that of that satellite. Therefore, you better cultivate the ideas of bringing about an understanding, religion, the humane things that you do with your surplus goods that you produce abundantly here, will all help you to bring about an understanding towards that lasting peace that we're all praying for. Thank you.
Formal debate procedure usually indicates that debate is concluded after a constructive and rebuttal speech. However, tonight, due to the question and the intensity of the debate, we are allowing two speeches left, two-minute rejoinders. And the first speaker, Representative McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thigh, and ladies and gentlemen, I suppose we might all feel better if we had had the constructive speeches at the end and had gone out feeling somewhat elevated. As it is, we're left more or less with the crumbs of this debate and got to rather pick it up. Well, I was interested in the Senator's observation that I had missed the vote on reciprocal trade. I don't think there's anyone in Congress who had any doubt as to how I would have voted on it. I was a member of the Ways and Means Committee, you know, which held hearings on it and voted to report the bill. As a matter of fact, when we first began to hold hearings on that bill, we couldn't get any Republicans on our committee to introduce the administration bill. And so I advised the President and the Cabinet that if they wanted me to do it, I said, I think it would look better if you had one of your own men do it. But if you can't get anyone, I hope that you will put aside partisanship and let a Democrat introduce the bill so we can get it moving. Well, that's the record. And since we've raised reciprocal trade, I do hope that the Senator will take a look at one of the publications the State Republican Campaign Committee is sending out, and I think the title is How to Attack McCarthy, I believe it is, on the farm issue. And the first item is he voted against an amendment to put an embargo on the importation of fats and oils and dairy products. Well, now that may have been a bad amendment, but I do hope that when the next publication comes out, they say that, well, when you say this about McCarthy's vote, I think it was in 51, it was back about that time, add a footnote saying that Senator Thigh in 1954 voted against a similar amendment. Now, insofar as mutual security is concerned, in point four, there are just two points I want to make. I think the Senator has given a good defense for postponement. The point is, after the postponement motion failed, as it did back in 1950, the next vote was on whether we should have it or not. And then he said no. And again in 1952, when point four was up, there was an amendment to provide that for every $3 spent for commodities and materials, only $1 might be spent for technical advice and training in the Near East and in Africa. Now, if there ever was an area in which technical training and advice were necessary, it was in the Near East and in Africa. And it seems to me a limitation of this kind was quite indefensible. And just one more point on the question of point four, or rather reciprocal trade. I must insist that my record be kept clear in that field because it is a consistent one of trying to liberalize the program and of trying to improve it. As a matter of fact, we recommended to the administration when the last extension was granted that they consider some kind of adjustment program so we could take care of any particular hardships which might be caused here at home. Because, as I said, we should not expect one particular group in our economy to bear the whole burden of what is done in the interest of the general welfare. And when they came back to us in this session of Congress, they led off with Sinclair Weeks. This was supposed to take the curse of the State Department off of reciprocal trade. They got the Secretary of Commerce. And we asked him about this, and he said, well, he'd heard something about some such proposition. This was something which the European Common Markets had considered and had incorporated in their program. This was something which we'd had hearings on in the Congress. And when we asked him whether he had any position on it, he said he'd heard about it. Now, one more vote on mutual security. In 1952, there was an amendment to reduce the total aid funds after they'd already been reduced by $1 billion by another $500 million. This was 52. Mr. Eisenhower was then the head of NATO. He hadn't received the dignity and the wisdom that went with the office of the presidency, evidently. Because in that year, he said that any cut materially greater than $1 billion, and this cut had already been made, and the proposition was to cut it another $500 million, and the general said any such cut would endanger United States security. And after that testimony, the senator voted to cut it another $500 million. Now, these are things in the record which I say may be defended. But the point is that I look for some consistency. I expect to support an administration in its foreign policy and in its requests to the extent that I can, and I have done that. And so I cite just these few, as I say, rather the crumbs of the debate. I would rather end it on a more friendly and a constructive tone, but this is what is left to us. And of course, in fact, a part of foreign policy is built up of little decisions like this along the way. These are not the whole matter of it, but they're not unrelated and insignificant. And so I say to you again, voters and potential voters and men who may influence voters, look at the record of the administration, look at the program of the administration, consider whether or not, with the kind of indecision which we've had for 6 years, with the indication that indecisiveness may be the mark of this administration for another 2 years, whether or not it might be better to have more strength in the party of opposition and more responsibility in the Congress of the United States.
The last speaker, the last 2 minute rejoinder, Senator Thigh.
Ladies and gentlemen, the most unpleasant thing is to talk about someone. You would much prefer to talk about what you would like to see accomplished. Now, it's unpleasant for me to have to say that the congressman voted on May the 29th, 1957, against restoring $313 million to the Defense Appropriation Bill. Now, certainly, if that vote came and we were jeopardizing our missiles program, it was not in the best interest of the United States when he cast that vote. And therefore, I've got to bring some of these to you. I told you of all the funds that we were appropriating under the then foreign aid mutual security, those huge sums, and yet they were coming up with additional programs that proposed to involve us in sums of which we had no end proof of what the cost would be, and therefore, some of us that recognized the then existing deficit in the Treasury had to take some steps to try to safeguard it. I told you about the $7 billion and plus that was in it. Now, here is the unpleasantness. And in all of my 16 years of campaigning, I have never had to get down and talk about these things in this manner. Some of these charges are brought to me. Some of these charges have been brought that were even then history in the 1952 campaign. And therefore, I have to ask why the congressman voted no on House passage of bill authorizing appropriations for Mutual Defense Assistance Act in 1949, if we go back to some ancient history of which I've apparently been subjected to here tonight. The bill authorized the appropriation of $869,505,000 for a one-year program of arms aid to friendly nations opposing communism in Europe and Asia. The bill passed by 238 with 122 votes recorded against. These are unpleasant things for me to have to bring up. But I'll bring them up whenever it becomes necessary If that's the kind of a campaign we must subject ourselves to, I could bring up a few more, but I don't intend to because it's unpleasant and messy.
Let us at this time thank both of the debaters for a very fine debate. At this time, we have allotted 30 minutes for questions from the audience, and the ushers are equipped with small cards. And with these small cards, we would like to write any questions down which you would like to, and they will be brought up here, and I will address the candidates. The candidates would prefer, rather than to be questioned now, I guess to be questioned later at the reception. So why don't we do it at that time?
Come over.
Go ahead.
Now, both the congressman and I turned. Come on. Step over here. Both the congressman and I turned to one another. It is now 9:30. This is one of the third debates that we've had in this week. You all were not present, of course, on Tuesday night. And the congressman and I were over in a private house on Lake of the Isles Boulevard here on Wednesday night. And we've been here. Now, you know that nothing is more pleasant than to see a knockdown, drag-out fight and a little bloodletting. We're both capable of it if it's necessary, but I don't think it's either in the interest of good sportsmanship and good ethics in politics to have to get down to that kind of campaigning. And therefore, I've always resented it. And I've always tried to avoid it. Now, if you want to ask a lot of questions, we could stay here for another 30 minutes. That'd be 10 o'clock. The congressman and I have been on a constant campaign here all fall, and I think we have pretty well covered the field, both foreign and otherwise. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and the congressman and I turned our heads together, and we said we were willing to call it quits. But if you insist, of course, we're not walking out or running out.
You want to go on? At this time, let me invite you all.
10 minutes is all that I do think that we should subject ourselves to.
Is that all right with you?
10 minutes?
10 minutes. The procedure we will follow then is 10 minutes for questioning, after which, if you have any questions, please come to the reception. Maybe this way we'll get many more to the reception. The reception will be held at the YMCA, which is just following the main street to your right, 1.5 blocks north, to the northwest corner, the YMCA. I wanted to remind you of that. But before that, are there any questions you have for in the 10 minutes we have allotted? Please raise your hand, and would the usher come to these people and bring the cards here? While you're doing that, I have three questions that have been presented to me as I walked in, and I'll ask them now. I'll ask one of them anyway. And this is addressed to both candidates. Would you briefly comment on the question specifically of what the United States should do today with regard to Quemoy? Representative McCarthy.
Well, I should confer with the State Department first so as not to expose our policy, but I think that there's general agreement, at least, that this should not be the beginning of an all-out war, and I think a general feeling that it will not be such. I'm quite convinced that it's not in the mind of the President or John Foster Dulles that it should become such. So this leaves us with the question of what do we do in the particular situation? Certainly we should not surrender to what is said to be the Chinese Communist intent that this should be a springboard or a lever which would force them to be recognized and admitted to the United Nations. That should not be done. I think a number of proposals that are going round have a measure of effectiveness in them. It should be taken to the United Nations. It should have been taken to the United Nations, I think, at least offered to them some 3 years ago when the first trouble broke out. If this seems an unsatisfactory solution, perhaps this is a question which the people of Asia might be permitted to decide, or at least they should be consulted. And I think that, at a minimum, perhaps a demilitarization of these islands is certainly in order. Because if they are to carry some 65 or 70,000 Chinese nationalist troops, then, of course, the Chinese on the mainland must consider this as a threat of invasion. At the same time, the people who are on these islands and the question of who is the rightful owners is one which requires some kind of international determination.
Senator Thai, would you like to comment to that, please?
In the main, I would say the Congressman's statement would stand without any questioning. There's no one of us that would want to go to war. But we must be firm. And I think a firmness proved the last time the islands were shelled that we intended to defend and the Red China ceased. And I believe that if we stand firm now, and the Red China has already said that they're willing to talk and discuss, and I would trust the State Department and the President in such a conference and such a discussion to safeguard the honor of this nation and also bring about some kind of an understanding and agreement that would not find it necessary to proceed with any further threatened shelling or defending. I believe that if the question gets into a conference stage, that there will be a resolve to the problem. And I would say that the Congressman's remarks on this question were good remarks.
It's almost an impossible task to sort these all out. And I can't vouch for their nonpartisanship, but I will ask them as they come up here. Congressman McCarthy, do you feel that not sufficient emphasis has been placed on economic aid by the present administration?
I would say yes,
Walter. Yes. Thank you. Senator Thai, do you believe it's possible to pass civil rights legislation under Democratic control of the Congress?
We have tried it. I have been there on the floor all night. I was caught in the chair as presiding officer at 2 o'clock one morning when it was utterly impossible to duck, and I stayed there till 10 o'clock the following morning. We sat night after night through full night conferences in the endeavor to break the filibuster, and we were still on the question of the motion to take up, and you'd have been subjected to the same identical if you had have gotten a cloture to have stopped debate on the take up, and if you would have then moved to discuss the motion, you'd have been faced with another filibuster. Now, I do believe that progress has been made. I will say that in all frankness and honesty to you, that progress has been made, and that I believe that progress will be made in the future. There is a will to an honest and a just civil rights decision in the Congress. But when it comes to the question of the rule for a simple majority, you would to amend the rule to make it a simple majority, I fear that you would find men both of the North and the South debating that question. Why? Because the minority group might find that a simple majority might be a problem to them, even though they resided in the North. Now, much debate has taken place on the civil rights issue over the 12 years that I've been in the Senate. And you could not fully understand it till you've had to sit in the presiding officer's chair for many, many hours at a time, as I've done when those filibusters were on, to understand the deep feeling of some of the men on this question. And therefore, I would say, and I'm not passing the responsibility entirely on the Democrats, but I would say they've been in control of that legislative body when there was too few Republicans on our side, as it was in the 30s, and they didn't do anything with it then, and they have been in control now in these past two sessions, and they have not done anything with it. I don't know how, when men can stand there for 24 hours plus without surrendering the floor, and they have a right to talk twice on a question, you know, how you're going to proceed with the 96. And not all those 96 would talk thusly, but quite a few of those would. Now, that's what you're faced with, and you might just as well have me be honest with you as to just simply say, well, it's all over here on the Democratic side, because then I wouldn't be honest. See? Now, that's my frankness to you. And I've sat through those filibusters. We tried for many, many days to amend Rule 22, and we just weren't able to do it.
Well, I just want to make one point, namely that the Civil Rights Bill was passed in 1957, and this Congress is a democratically controlled Congress. And to make the further point that the 80th Congress was controlled by Republicans, we had a Democratic president who was for civil rights and no action was taken. And again, for two terms after 1952, the Republicans controlled the Congress and there was no action on civil rights. So that here is the record. It may not be as good a bill as we would like, but it's the only one that's been passed. And it was passed under a democratically controlled Congress, which was a question.
I'll pose one more question here, and then perhaps at the reception immediately following, we can answer the 60 or so that remain. To both candidates, do you favor a world federation with adequate but limited power and authority for supervising and enforcing a universal disarmament agreement? If so, what would you do toward this if you were elected?
Read that question again.
All right.
I did not hear the first of it.
All right. Do you favor a world federation with adequate but limited power and authority for supervising and enforcing a universal disarmament agreement preventing aggression? Whichever one of you chooses to speak first, go ahead.
First, I'm going to comment on that civil rights question. There was much criticism of that civil rights, and it came very short of fulfilling the true spirit of what is embodied in civil rights. Remember that. It was a watered-down civil rights. Now, the next is, on such a world federalist question, I would only comment in this manner, that there is so much involved in such a question and the possibility of your own sovereignty as a nation being in jeopardy, that I do neither believe that we're ready for such a question. I have felt strongly about the UN, that the UN would have to have within it the body that could determine as to what should be the conduct of nations within the world. And like a city council, for instance, adopt a set of rules pertaining to the conduct of the citizens of their city. And then you have a simple method of enforcing that, and that is your policing power. Not many is required to maintain law and order. I believe when the UN has grown to its full stature, you will have such an international body within it that can determine what is the proper conduct of nations, leaders in the society of nations, and when they are in error. Economic boycotts can be exercised in such a manner that that leader cannot survive at the head of his nation. And if not, then do as we did when there was this uprising and that our troops were put in Lebanon. I believe the UN can thus be perfected in order to maintain peace and order throughout the world.
Well, I would say that I'm in general agreement with the Senator. I think some of us are concerned right now as to whether we can hold the Union together. What we need to move on to is to the perfection of the United Nations in much the way that the Senator has pointed out. Although I do say that I think the UN can continue to stress the question of disarmament, although disarmament is a secondary consideration to establishing the conditions of peace. The note that you cannot have peace without disarmament or disarmament without peace, as the President said, is not quite accurate. You cannot have disarmament unless you have peace. That's the primary consideration, and that should be the order of our efforts and of our action. Let me say that I encourage the World Federalists. I don't think they're a dangerous movement.
Let me thank you very much for your very kind attention and urge you at this time to go to the YMCA for the reception. Thank you very much.